classical simulation of quantum many body systems.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I want to say that it's a pleasure to be here, and I would like to thank Daniel Bottesman, he's not here, for inviting me to come and also losing Harvey. And well, today I wanted to explain you some of the recent results we I have been working in at the University of Barcelona, which basically is about properties of quantum many body systems and properties about the entanglement laws along parameter flows, and some properties of the systems that we will be considering, and also the classical simulability of quantum many body systems, which basically is an introduction you will see to matrix for the states and things related. So let me sketch you a little bit what is going to be the working scenario in which we are going to move all the time. On the one hand, we have the field of quantum information and computation, right? Which has many interesting things going on, like entanglement theory or adiabatic quantum algorithms, right? Quantum computing in general. But we also have some other fields of physics, like condensed matter physics, which in some sense overlap, with, in some practical sense, with things of quantum information. For example, we know that in condensed matter physics, we have, there are people which have been studying for many, many years things like quantum phase transitions and density matrix renormalization group, or DMRT, as the people call it. And it is known that now we understand why density matrix renormalization group works pretty well in some cases, because we understand better entanglement theory. And also we understand better adiabatic quantum algorithms, because in some sense they are related to quantum phase transitions. So there is a flow of information between these two fields that is going on here, right? Let me put in this picture a third field of physics, which is high energy physics, and more concretely, quantum field theory, which of course has intersections with all the others. And things that are going on here that can be related with quantum information and condensed matter physics are fields like conformal field theory, or the area law for the black hole entropy, right? So all these things can be related either with entanglement theory or quantum phase transitions, sensitive matrix normalization group, and there is like some kind of interdisciplinary research going on here that I find quite interesting. And I think this is worth studying, and this is basically one of the motivations for giving this talk and for studying the things that I'm going to explain you today. So let me sketch you very briefly what has been my work at Barcelona so far. At the beginning, I began making something about entanglement theory and materialization in quantum algorithms. I also studied classical computational complexity and also entanglement in quantum algorithms and quantum phase transitions. But today, I wanted to talk to you about the last two things I've been working in, which is materialization and entanglement laws along parameter flows and renormalization group flows for quantum many body systems, and also about classical simulability of quantum many body systems. So let me go for the first part of the talk, which is materialization and entanglement laws along parameter flows and renormalization group flows. Let me sketch you what is materialization theory. I guess that most of you may already know, but just for completeness. So materialization theory is a theory that studies the notion of ordered probability distributions, right? Mm-hmm. Then we consider two probability distributions, x and y, right? Which are two probability vectors, so the sum of all the components add up to one. Now I'm going to say that probability distribution x is majorized by probability distribution y. I'm going to put this symbol here to denote this notion of materialization, if and only if, and these are three equivalent definitions. The first one is that probability distribution X can be obtained as a probabilistic sum of permutations of the probability vector Y, right? The second definition is a definition that is based on a set of B minus one inequalities that have to be fulfilled by some partial sums of the components of the probability distributions, right? And the third equivalent definition, what says is that X is related to Y by a doubly stochastic matrix, right? This is telling you in some sense that the probability distribution X is more disordered than the probability distribution Y. Here you can see very easily why, because this is X can be obtained as a mixture of permutations of the distribution Y. Right. So this is giving you a notion of order of probability distributions, which is indeed stronger than the one provided by the channel entropy. Yes.
Are those three equivalent?
Yes. the three are here. If one is satisfied, then the other two are satisfied. Right? So modularization imposes a very strong sense of order in probability distributions. Now, let me define you what they will understand by global monotonous and fine-grained entanglement laws. Imagine that they have a physical system, which is defined by a Hamiltonian. It can be whatever, think of a spin chain, of whatever system that you can think, okay? And we compute the ground state of it that we're going to call it omega, right? Now, imagine that your system depends on some parameter, T, which can be either a magnetic field, an anisotropy, whatever, right? And because the system is depending on this parameter, of course, the density, the vacuum is also going to depend on this parameter, right? And now I'm going to split my universe, my system, into two parts, part A and part B, right? And I'm going to consider the reduced density matrix for part A, or the reduced value class, some people say, for part A, right? And right, and the way of obtaining this is by tracing of part B of the system. Now I'm going to make a transformation. I'm going to move parameter from a value that is called T1 to another value, which is T2. Let me assume that T2 is bigger than T1, just because this is just an example. And because I'm moving this parameter, I'm also making a change in the state of density matrix, right? Which is parameterized by this parameter T. Now, let me assume that I will say that, I will say that they have some global entanglement loss if the entanglement entropy between party A and party B, which is what is represented here, at T1 is bigger than the entanglement entropy at T2, right? So when I'm moving along this flow, I'm losing entanglement, right? But this is a global statement, right? Because this only involves two points in this space, right? Now, one step further in refining this this notion of entanglement laws is defining the monotonous entanglement law, which is saying, okay, we have this monotonicity here that the entropy is decreasing, but it is a monotonic property all along this flow, right? So this derivative is indeed negative. And one step further in this sense is going to monotonic measurization along the flow, which is this fine-grained entanglement loss that I'm saying here, which is nothing that along this path, the reduced density, the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix of the system, right, are measurized at each step by the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix at the next step, right, along the flow. Okay. This is what is understood by fine-grained entanglement loss or monotonic measurization along the parameter flow. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, when you do this majorization, the slide that you had before was talking about permutations.
Yes.
And if you now, in the quantum regime, what plays the role of your permutation? Do you have a basis that's singled out?
You mean, what do you, I mean, no, there's no problem here. The point is that this is a probability vector, okay? I have my density matrix, I diagonalize it, and then they get values to find a probability distribution,
okay?
This is what is understood by this. And if I say that there is majorization between these two probability distributions, then it means that some of the other three equivalent definitions is fulfilled, okay? In particular, there is, you can, if this is, if this density matrix is majorized by this other one, then you can find permutations and probabilities such that the definition holds. I don't know if I answered to your question. Okay.
Yeah, yes. I just need to look at this one. Okay, thanks. How does second and third definition equivalent?
Sorry?
How is my understanding of less equivalent to find real entanglement?
It works to me.
Is the second point equivalent to the third?
This point equivalent to this one? No. No, because in fact, this point implies the order, right? Because from majorization you can prove the monotonicity of the entanglement entropy, right? But the other way around is not true. Okay. This is one step farther with the derivation. Okay. So I'm going to talk to you about precisely this question of majorization. Okay, so let me schedule, because in the forthcoming transparencies it will appear, what is conformal symmetry. Very briefly, first of all, I'm not an expert on conformal field theory, right? I guess that some people here they know very much about these things. And but with this transparency, the only thing I want to do is to motivate why I'm going to talk all the time about conformal symmetry, conformal field theory, and so on. in what follows. No? So one way of motivating conformal symmetry is the following, a physical way of motivating it, is that you know that physical properties of quantum critical theories or systems are dictated by scaling values. Right? So if I have a critical system, it doesn't matter whether I look it at this scale or at this scale or at the following one because the system is similar, right? And well, you know that if you make a coarse grain of your system, basically everything is identical. Okay. That is what is meant by scaling values. Here I'm representing a scaling system that it can be whatever. So in the continuum limit, that is in the limit in which the distance between the spins, I'm always thinking about the spins, right, goes to zero, when these theories are described in terms of some quantum field theory, sometimes it happens that the symmetry group is larger. It's not only scaling variance, but there are also some other symmetries hidden there, like Lorentz symmetry, and also some symmetries that are called spatial conformal transformations. Okay, so all these symmetries form what is called the conformal group, right? And because we have a quantum field theory that is invariant under something that we call conformal group, this is called a conformal field theory, right? Which is nothing but a quantum field theory that has something that is called conformal symmetry, okay? Which is a generalization of the scaling variance. Now, just for the sake of it, I put here what is the shape of one of these conformal transformations. This is the metric of our quantum field theory. And when I change, this is the space-time coordinate. And when this space-time coordinate is transformed according to a conformal transformation, what happens in the metric is that it is rescaled by something that is called a conformal factor, okay, which depends on the form. What is important for us for understanding what is going to happen in the forward is that conformal symmetry completely determines all the physical properties of critical theories in 1+1 dimensions. And when I'm saying 1+1 dimensions, one is referring to space, and another one is referring to time, which is usually fixed, right? So when I mean 1+1 dimensions, I'm always, what I want to say is always one spatial dimension and one temporal dimension, right? This is what happens, for example, in a spin chain, okay? Or some critical spin chains, like the X-prime model, X-X model, all this. So let me go for the first result. We were able to prove majorization with L in conformal field theory with 1+1 dimensions. And for this, let me imagine that I have one of these theories with conformal symmetry that again I represented by a critical system of spins, for example. The system is infinite, and I'm going to consider the ground state of this system, right, and the density matrix of a subsystem of size L. Okay. And I'm going to call this density matrix reduced density matrix rho L. What we were able to prove using all the machinery of conformal field theory is that the reduced density matrix of the vacuum of this interval gets more and more order in the sense of majorization as long as the size of the interval grows up. Okay. So the bigger is the size of the interval, the more order is the probability distribution that is behind the reduced density matrix. Okay. And we were able to prove this for all possible conformal field theories in 1+1 dimensions. So the result is very general. The way we were able to do this was by explicit evaluation of the reduced density matrix. Okay. And basically, this depends on one parameter that is called the central charge, which defines the universality class of field theory. Right? And well, it depends also on some operators that we call the zero Virasoro operators, and then some factor Q, which the important point here is that it is a monotonic function of the size of the interval. Right. And in order to make it a little bit more clear, an example of this is the XX quantum spin chain, which is defined by this Hamiltonian here. This Hamiltonian is critical, right? The gap between the first excited state and the ground state energy is zero. And then because of criticality, well, you can describe this Hamiltonian in the continuum limit by one of these conformal field theories. And it was proven by Peschel in 2004 that the reduced density matrix precisely of an interval of size L has some properties which are very much alike this general form of the reduced density matrix here. And also you can see that the Yoway majorization relations. So this is telling you the way in which the ground state of critical theories gets more and more ordered or organized or organizes itself when you are varying parameters, no? Say, for example, the size of the interval that you are studying or the rest of the parameters of your model, no? Okay, so another thing that we can study is modularization along flows in the parameters. So let me imagine that I have a theory or a system that depends on a set of parameters that I'm going to call G1, G2, whatever, and I'm going to represent it by a vector parameters, okay? And now in the space of all the values, all the possible values of the parameters, I have a point which I call G star. And I call it a conformal point, but you can think of it as the critical point or a fixed point of the normalization group, okay? Which is basically the same. Basically, it is the same idea. I'm going to think of moving in the parameter space along a given direction, okay? That is given by the unity vector k. And the way I'm going to parameterize the movement along this direction is by some parameter that I'm going to call a, right? Now, when I move a, when a is bigger than zero, I'm going away of the critical point, or the conformal point. Okay? And when a goes to zero, I recover criticality. Right? Here, what we prove is a little bit more technical, but let me excuse you. We prove that if the reduced density matrices along this line, that is for these values of the vector of parameters, preserves the same structure than at the critical point. And by that, I mean that those reduced density matrices can be still calculated. Once they are calculated, they are still of the same form that I have shown you in the previous transparency. They depend on some parameters Q. And these parameters Q are basically monotonic function of the parameters, which is what I'm assuming here, along this flow. Then there is modularization along this flow. So as long as I move away of the critical point, the density matrix of the vacuum of the ground state gets more and more ordered. Okay? And this has some physical sense because this is telling you that as long as I go away with criticality, the system is more ordered. And the maximum disorder is going to be achieved precisely when the point at the critical point of the theory, right? Which is typically the point at which the entropy has a peak and it is maximum, and it is indicating you that you have maximal disorder here, right? But this is in even a stronger sense in the sense of majorization. And well, and this is also for conformal field theories which have this particular structure. Here, just a couple of remarks for those of you who know about renormalization group, is that if the parameter A coincides with the scale of a renormalization group flow, then what we have proven here is continuous majorization along renormalization group flow for some integral theories, right, by construction. I call them integrable because I know how to solve these theories explicitly because I have given you the explicit form of the reduced density matrix by construction, okay, because it's an hypothesis of my theorem. And also, if the theory has only one parameter, one can see using a tool for a normalization group that the monotonicity of the parameter along the RG flow is trivial, it's very easy to see, just by studying the behavior of the beta functions, but modularization of the reduced vacuum is not trivial, which is what we have proven here. So an example of this is what happens for the XY quantum spin chain. So the XY quantum spin chain is defined by this Hamiltonian, right? It has some interaction. So near the neighbor interaction in the x direction, in the y direction, there is an anisotropy, which is called gamma, and also some magnetic field, which is called lambda. And in terms of these two parameters, the phase diagram, something like this. For gamma equal to zero, and varying lambda, we have what is called the critical XX model. For gamma equal to one, basically this term disappears, and what you have is the icing model, which is critical for lambda equal to one, that is the critical point. And for lambda equal to one, all this line is critical, and it's called the critical XY model, and belongs to the same universality class as the icing model, basically. So I'm going to think of an infinite spin chain, and I'm going to reduce half. I'm going to trace out half of the system, right? And I'm going to compute the reduced density matrix for a half infinite chain, which is what is represented here, right? Of course, this reduced density matrix depends on the two parameters of the spin chain, the anisotropy and the magnetic field. And it was computed by Peschel that this reduced density matrix, something like this, the exponential of some sum of some numbers here and some energies, and these numbers he proved that there are some fermionic occupation numbers. Basically, they can be either 0 or 1. And this energy is here at some monotonic function of the two parameters. And I'm going into detail of this. Okay. Now, because of this monotonicity, it is possible to prove that majorization relations hold along the flows in lambda and gamma. Okay. And also, some technical point is that for gamma equal to 1, you can prove that the flow in lambda coincides precisely with a randomization group flow. That is, the flow that you get when you are making a coefficient of your system is precisely moving along this line for the Ising model. Okay. And you, then, in this case, you have proven that the flow in lambda coincides with an RC flow, and then you have majorization along a randomization group flow. Yes?
So you're working with a gross field of symmetry?
Yes.
Well, what if it's degenerate?
No. Well, what if it's degenerate? No, but in this case, you can the wrong state of the system, you can compute it explicitly from the correlator. Right? In this case, it is not degenerate because the theory is not critical. Okay. For example, in the Ising model, you have degeneracy here when lambda is equal to 0. And the state that you have, the wrong state, is a GH state. It's a superposition of all the spins up and all the spins down, basically. But in this case, you have degeneracy, but what happens is that this state is not physical. You can argue that you can say that it's not, well, you can see some principles that are called clustering principles of quantum field theories and so on that the GH set violates. And then what happens is that you must have some spontaneous symmetry rating or something like that that creates the degeneracy. And then you just have to study one of the right. Another remark is that, this is something interesting for those that are working in the field of high energy physics, is that something that is very difficult to prove, apparently, is irreversibility of renormalization group flow. Right? There is a proof of irreversibility of renormalization group flow for 1+1 dimensions, which was provided by Samolodikov, I think it was in the 80s, using conformal field theories again. And the proof of this statement for higher dimensions has been seen to be very, in principle, very difficult. Okay, there are several proposals of Hardy and some other people, but in principle, it's something that is not easy to see. Right? So maybe majorization in this way, maybe using majorization in this way, it would be possible to try to prove a reversibility of renormalization group flow in an alternative way. Right? So maybe this could be an inspiration for those that are working in this. Okay, so let me schedule a couple of other results which have nothing to do with what I explained you right now, but which I think they are also interesting because they have to do with conformal field theory and some research we have been doing lately. One of them is related with what we call the single copy entanglement. What is the single copy entanglement? You know that by definition, the definition of the entanglement entropy, what is telling you is the optimal rate at which you can be still maximally entangled pairs from a bipartite system, okay, using local operations and classical communications between the two parties, and in the limit of having an infinite number of copies of your system. Right. Now, you can say that experimentally, that is very difficult to have an infinite number of copies of your system, and you can wonder what you can ask what is going to happen in the case of having only just one copy. No. So the maximal entanglement that is possible to achieve by local operations and classical communications in the case of having only one copy, okay, of a bipartite system is what is called the single copy entanglement. Okay. Now, we proved that the single copy entanglement has also some scaling laws which are very similar to the ones of the entanglement entropy for conformal field theories. Okay. And in particular, we proved that it scales asymptotically as half the entanglement entropy for conformal field theories in 1+1 dimensions. Okay. This is the entanglement entropy, which scales like C over 3 logarithm of L, and C is the central charge of the system. And the single copy entanglement has a leading term, which is C over 6 logarithm of L, which is half of the entanglement entropy. Okay. And we were able also to compute the first order correction, which goes like 1 over logarithm of L. A second result that I wanted to tell you is something related to entanglement in a model that is called the Lipkin-Meshkov-Glick model, which is nothing but a spin model, like the XY spin Hamiltonian, but instead of defined on a line, it is defined on a simplex, that is a completely connected graph. Okay. Now, we were able to prove, in some sense, in some particular cases, and to see explicitly by numerical evaluations in some others, that the entanglement entropy in this model behaves as if the model, although it is defined on a simplex, it's not defined in one dimension, it seems that this model is governed by an underlying conformal symmetry in 1+1 dimensions. Basically, the entropy scales like some effective central charge times a logarithm. Okay. And we are sure of this thing also because we also computed the behavior of the reduced optical values of the reduced density matrix and saw that it had a very particular shape that is always going on in the case of 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory. Okay.
Yes.
So
what's L?
L is the size of the interval that you are studying. You have an infinite. Here in this case, it's the number of spins that you are facing off. I'm not explaining this in too detail, but basically what happens is that you have a simplex, okay, of n spins, okay, a very big number of spins, and you, because all the spins are equivalent, you just take a subset of L of them, okay, and now you can see that the scaling of the entropy is precisely the same as if the spins were placed on a line. It seems as if under some kind of strange transformation, you can map this system to a one-dimensional system. And this is a model that the people used to study, for example, Bose-Einstein condensation. So with this, I finish the first part of the talk. I'm going to explain you now something a little bit different, which is classical simulation of quantum many-body systems. And let me just motivate it very briefly, very easily. So we all know that it is impossible, by principle, to simulate a quantum computer with a classical computer. Okay. And a very nice way of seeing this is that imagine that I want to describe a system of n qubits, right? I have 2^n coefficients that I have to keep in my resistor, in my classical computer, and of course this is going to grow up exponentially. And because I have this exponential growth, in principle, this is not efficient to simulate. Okay, I cannot keep all these coefficients in my computer because I have exponentially many of them. So this is, in some sense, the reason why exact classical simulations of generic Hamiltonians, and by simulations I mean computing ground states, dynamical evolutions, correlators, whatever, are only possible up to more or less of the order of 24 spins. Okay? Or qubits with exact methods, let's say. And this was the motivation, as founded by Feynman in 82, to build a quantum computer. So let me advance you what is the result of this part. Is that we have efficiently simulated approximated quantum computations, where by approximated, you will see later what I mean by these approximations, up to 100 qubits with matrix probe states, which is nothing but a way of reparametrizing these coefficients. Okay. So what are matrix probe states? Imagine that they have some particles, okay, which are represented by these dots. And I'm going to call these particles ancillary particles. Okay. Now, these particles, I assume that they are in some kind of dimerized state, okay, such that each one of these bonds represents a maximally entangled pair of two ancillas. Okay. And in principle, these ancillas can be of whatever dimension. They don't have to be qubits, qubits, whatever. And I assume that the dimension of these ancillas is going to be chi. Okay. Now these circles represent projections. So what I'm going to do is, over this dimerized state, I'm going to pick up these two lines. And I'm going to project the Hilbert space of these two ancillas into some physical space that in the end will represent my qubit, my qutrit, or my physical particle. Okay? So this is a projection from a local system. And these projectors are represented by matrices. Okay? For example, you can see in this one, the indices below, alpha 1 and alpha 2, are referring to the ancillary particles. Alpha 1 is referring to the one on the left, and alpha 2 is referring to the one on the right, okay? And the physical index is going to be I2. This is the index that is going to be running from 1 to the physical dimension of my particle. 2 if it's qubits, 3 if it is qubits, whatever. Okay. So this state based on projectors, if you work it down, you can see that it has this shape. Okay. And in the end, what has happened here is that the coefficient that was here in front has been reparametrized in terms of products of matrices. Okay. And that is why this is called a matrix product state. Mm-hmm. Now, these indices run from 1 to b. B will be the physical dimension of my particle. And the alphas go from 1 to chi, where chi is the ancillary dimension. Right? Now, a couple of years ago, this same decomposition was rediscovered incidentally by Giffre Vidal by means of making some successive Smith decompositions of the system. And well, he saw that these matrices admit a further decomposition in terms of some other matrices that he called gamma and some Smith numbers, which I call lambda. Okay. And these Smith numbers are very interesting because we have chi Smith coefficients, and we know that this is not chi, it's nothing but the Smith number of the particular bipartition of the system, okay, that we are considering. So, for example, imagine that I make a bipartition here of my system. I have a reduced density matrix, and the rank of this reduced density matrix is going to be this number chi, which is ancillary dimension. Right. And we know that this is a measure of entanglement. Basically, this is of the order of the exponential of the entanglement entropy. So this is very good because this is a parametrization of my quantum state in terms of some matrices, and the size of these matrices basically depend on how entangled, how much bipartite entanglement I have in my system. Okay, and this is measured by this number chi. There are generalizations of this. This is, in, as you can imagine, in one dimension and with open boundary conditions, but you can generalize it to more than one dimension, and this is what is these PETs, projected entangled states of Frank der Streite and Ignacio Cirac. And there is also another generalization very recent from Giffre Vidal, which is with disentangling unitaries, which are called mediums. So I think it's multi-scale entanglement renormalization answers or something like that. Now, why matrix for the states are good? The first reason is that the state is represented with n times d times chi squared parameters instead of d to the n. And this can be very good, because imagine that I have a quantum state for which this number chi here is polynomially big in the number of qubits. Okay? Then this representation of my quantum state is going to be efficient, right, in terms of products of matrices. This is typically what happens in a quantum spin chain. Another reason is that any quantum state can be represented as a matrix product state with large enough chi. This means that MPS is a dense set of states. You can represent any state as a matrix product state. Also, physical observables, for example, correlators, but also expected energy, which is nothing but combinations of correlators, typically, can be computed in a time which grows only polynomially in chi. Okay. And also, they allow to compute low energy properties of Hamiltonians with algorithms like the density matrix renormalization group, or also Euclidean time evolution, or real time evolution, they call it sometimes. And also, they allow to compute the dynamics of quantum states. And these two large properties are very interesting because they work very well for quantum many body systems in one special dimensions, basically because of the reason that I was telling you before, the entanglement scales logarithmically, and then this number chi is polynomial, and then the cost of computing the low energy properties of these Hamiltonians or the dynamics is going to be only polynomially big. Okay. This is the reason why the density matrix normalization group works very well in one dimension. Right. Okay, so let me sketch you very briefly how to compute ground states with matrix for the states. So the aim is to compute the ground state properties of some Hamiltonian H, and the idea is very simple. I'm going to compute this expected value, and this expected value, if this state is parametrized in terms of the matrices, is going to be a quadratic function of all the matrices. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is to fix all the values of the matrices to some particular value, And I'm going to minimize this expected value over the first matrix, right? Now, after optimizing over the first matrix, I optimize over the second. Then after I optimize the third one, and so on. And I finish. And after I've done this trip, then I go to the left side, OK? I optimize over this matrix, over the following, then over this, and so on, until I optimize over the first one. And then I sweep back and forth all the time. And I'm doing this all the time until I achieve some convergence, okay, which is an external parameter that I want for my algorithm. And with this, I compute this Brown state energy up to some accuracy, right, for a fixed value of time. Yes?
So this matrix A, over which parameters is it varying? So can you predict?
Sorry? Over which parameter? No. I'm just the technical point here is that when you fix all the matrices and you want to optimize over this, okay, you can see that this expected value, optimizing this expected value, you can reduce it to a typical eigenvalue problem. Okay, you can restate this matrix as a vector, okay, and then optimizing over this vector is nothing but finding the lowest energy eigenvector or some effective Hamiltonian that you can work with the other matrices. Okay, this is somehow a technical problem, but computationally it's very easy to do. Mm-hmm. So this optimization is nothing but the density matrix renormalization group algorithm, but stated in terms of matrix product states. Right? So this is nothing but TMRG. So an example of a calculation of the ground state energy of some theory is this one, the harmonic chain. Imagine I have a chain of harmonic oscillators, right? And these oscillators are interacting. Right? This is nothing but the discretization on a lattice of a quantum field theory of a free boson, phi 2, with some mass that is mu, okay, which corresponds with the frequency of these oscillators once discretized. Right? So this theory is critical when the mass is approximately zero, and it's not critical when the mass is not zero. It's parameter mu. And here I show you computations for 30 oscillators. And you can see that the relative error for the energy that we achieve outside of criticality is of the order of 10 to the minus 8, which is a very high accuracy. And outside criticality, the error is bigger, so it has to correspond for a critical theory, and it's of the order of 10 to the minus 4. Right? And here, what happens, what I'm showing you is the error as a function of parameter chi, which is the entanglement present in your resistor, and also another parameter, which is d, which is the local dimension of your Hilbert space, which in this case has also to be truncated, because here the local dimension of the oscillators is infinite. Okay, and at some point we have to truncate it, and that is an extra approximation that we have to do for computing in our simulations, in this case. Okay. The point here is that with this transparency, I want to show you that this optimization over matrix flow states and the density matrix normalization group algorithm can also be extended to systems of continuous variables, like this. Okay, X and P are continuous variables, like here. Fine, the field is something that is principal continuous. Now, how do you compute dynamics with matrix product states? There are several ways of evaluating the dynamics. I'm going to show you here one of the possibilities. Imagine that I want to make a local gate over the particle of the system, local system A, and this local gate is UA. So it's very easy to update my quantum state. The only thing that I have to do is to update the matrix that is corresponding to the system A, okay, in this way, very simple. And the new matrix for the state is defined in terms, again, of the new matrix. Now, what happens if I do a quantum gate between two systems, which is non-local, right? Imagine that these systems are close together, they are adjacent, okay? So over systems A and A plus 1, it's a little bit technical, okay? I'm not going to enter into the details, but let me sketch you basically what we have to do. Is you compute this object, which is nothing but the action of the unitary gate against the two matrices that are involved, right? And then you have to rediagonalize some reduced density matrix of your system. And after rediagonalizing this, you are able to express, again, this product here as a product of two new matrices. Right? And these two new matrices, of course, depend on the unitary that you have. Now, the nice thing that one can see when doing this evaluation is that before applying this unitary gate, this index that is joining the two matrices runs from 1 to k. And this index, basically, the rank of this index is measuring how much entangled is this bipartition of your system between the system I and A plus 1. Okay. Now, after making this further diagonalization, what you can see is that this index beta, which is joining the two systems, runs from 1 to d times chi. Okay. And this is the new chi. Okay. This is the new rank of the reduced density matrix, d times chi, which has grown. Okay. So this is the way in which a two cubic case entangle the system, create entanglement. Right. And of course, this growth is exponential because this is a multiplicative factor. Every time I apply a 2-qubit gate, I'm multiplying by this factor d. Right? And if I want to make a classical simulation of this time evolution in my computer, at some point I have to truncate this exponential growth. Okay. And for 2-qubit gates that act on qubits that are very far away and on adjacent systems, one possibility that you have is to swap your systems until they are together, and then you apply the previous idea. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about how to truncate this exponential growth of entanglement. There are basically two ways of making this truncation, or two proposals. One is a local procedure which only involves the two matrices in which I'm acting. Okay, this was proposed by Lipteridan, and the idea is very simple. You only have to his proposal for truncating is just to retain only a fixed number chi of terms that carry most of the entanglement in the decomposition. That is, when making this rediagonalization, what you have to do is you only keep the first chi term and forget about the others. Okay. This is a very drastic truncation, but it works up to some point. And with this, of course, entanglement is part of truncation. Now, the other option is to make a non-local procedure that was proposed by Frank Verstrete and Ignacio Firan, and is to compute a whole new, a very big new matrix for the states, matrix for the state in terms of new matrices, with indices up to a fixed chi such that the distance with the exact state is minimum. So I'm optimizing over all the matrices such that this difference is minimal. Not only the two matrices in which the 2-qubit gate is applied, but all of them. Okay, so this updating is non-local. And this is a precision-inspired truncation method. In principle, it is optimal. Optimal in the sense of precision. So we applied, as a first step, the first local procedure in our simulations of time evolution. Now, what we simulated was an adiabatic quantum algorithm. You can consider this as a warm-up for the workshop that is going to happen on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday here. No? Probably most of you already know what is an adiabatic quantum algorithm, but let me remind you. The thing is that we want to compute the ground state of some problem Hamiltonian, which is called HP. And this problem Hamiltonian, in principle, codifies the solution to a problem in its ground state. Typically, it's a minimization problem. Okay. But the way to find this ground state is, okay, let me begin with an easy-to-prepare Hamiltonian that I'm going to call in 0. And I know how to prepare the ground state of this guy. Right? Now, the idea is very simple. I'm going to make an interpolation in time between the easy Hamiltonian and the complicated Hamiltonian that is HP, and governed by some parameter P, which is time. Okay, and if I'm evolving slowly enough and there are no crossings in the energy levels, then because of the adiabatic theorem, if the time in which I evolve is bigger than some quantity in this case, like 1 over the minimum gap squared, okay, then I will end in the ground state of the problem Hamiltonian with a very high probability, which is the solution to my problem, right? This is the typical plot that you have for the ground state energy and the first excited state, the first excited energy. This is the reduced time, okay? This is the time in your simulation. At some point, you have a minimum gap, okay? And the scaling of this minimum gap is the thing that is governing the scaling of the time that you have to evolved with your adiabatic algorithm. And this is very nice because this is the evolution of a physical system, or a quantum, you can think as an, this is the evolution of an adiabatic quantum computer close to a quantum phase transition, right? We are not at a quantum phase transition point because the gap is not exactly zero, but we are evolving close to it. Okay, so this is nothing but the evolution of a system close to a critical point. And this is a very nice and physical idea because the adiabatic algorithms are a universal model of making quantum computers. Okay, so the problem that we want to solve is an NP-complete problem that is called Texan solver. I'll just remind you very quickly what is it about. I have an instance. An instance of this problem is a set of clauses, constraints over n bits, and a clause for bits I, j, k is satisfied only if the bits are in the configurations 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, or 0, 0, 1. Right. Now, the problem is given a set of clauses to know whether this is an assignment of the n bits that satisfies all the clauses or not. This is a decision problem. And this problem is NP-complete. Right? And it has been seen that there is like a phase transition in the set of classical instances. And hard classical instances come at a value of at a rate of clauses over bits that is of the order of 0.5. So, the adiabatic algorithm solving at self-cover is performing the following way. For H0, we basically pick up a magnetic field in the x direction, right? And for the proper Hamiltonian, it's nothing but the sum of Hamiltonians for each one of the clauses in this way. This is a quadratic Hamiltonian in the spins, right? And we end up with a Hamiltonian, which is highly non-local interacting, okay, of spins. Right, but this is highly non-local. This is not defining one dimension into what dimension can be whatever. Right, and it depends on one parameter, which is S, something like a magnetic field, but in this case is the time, okay, or the reduced time. This S here is the small t divided by the computational time. It's interpolation parameter. Now, some average numerical scalings of the order of 20 qubits seem to indicate that the computational time seems to grow like n squared, apparently up to 20 qubits, and that the maximal Smith rank of the reduced density matrices seems to grow exponentially in n, okay? Like this, with 0.1 in the exponent. Now, of course, because this is exponential, this can be simulated efficiently on a classical computer, right? But the point is that this coefficient here, the 0.1, is in principle small, and maybe this opens the possibility for good simulations using matrix probe states for many qubits. Okay. Now, okay, in order to simulate this adiabatic quantum algorithm, what we did was a discretization of gates into unitary gates of the unitary time evolution operator, right? I'm not going to enter into detail of this, but you can prove, well, you can see that you can make a discretization of the time evolution operators in terms of basically 1 and 2 qubit gates. And then we we wrote the simulation algorithm on the program. We put as an input these unitary matrices defining some instance, okay? And then we launched our simulations to see how were the results. And here are the results. For example, for this is the expected energy for 30 qubits. In the insert, there are the exact expected energies, okay? For increasing values of chi, as long as chi is big, the simulation is more precise. And here is the relative error of the simulation, which is the biggest error is of course obtained when we are evolving close to the quantum phase transition point, right? And here the errors that we see were on the order of 10 to the minus 3. So this is a good accuracy in a small computational time as compared to the exact simulations. Okay. A way of seeing what is the error that we are doing in our simulations is to see what is the loss of norm in the quantum state. Of course, we have a loss of norm in our simulations because every time we are playing a 2-qubit gate, we are making a truncation in the gain values of a reduced density matrix, right? And when doing this truncation, the sum of the gain values that I'm retaining is not going to be 1 anymore, it's going to be less than 1, and we are doing all this every time we are playing a 2-qubit gate. So here is the norm at the end of the computation for different values of chi and different values of n. And we see that, as we expected, there is an increasing precision with increasing chi. So the norm in some cases is very small, right? Okay, another thing that we can do is think we can study small systems with very high precision, that is increasing chi very much. But let me imagine the situation in which I consider a very big system, for example, 100 of qubits, and I compute it with a very drastic approximation. So chi is going to be very small. Okay? So the point is that we are able to solve a half instance of 100 qubits with one of these simulations with a chi which is remarkably small, which is only 14, compared to the maximum allowed value, which is 2 to the 50. Right? And here is the result. This is the entanglement entropy, which of course is very bad because it's the parameter in which we are truncating. And this is the probability of success, which basically is 0 all the time, and that when we are close to the criticality, it jumps to 1. Right? And this is finding the correct solution among basically 10 to 30 possibilities. Mm-hmm. I think this is nice because keeping only chi equal to 14, which is more or less saying that you are keeping a superposition of only 14 product states, okay, along this evolution, up to 2 to the 50 possibilities, you are picking one guy among 10 to the 30. Okay, and we also did some statistics. We launched simulations for several values of chi and several values of n until our these simulations were successful. And the time in which the simulation was successful, we store it, and then we did the statistics, right? And this is the statistical time for succeeding in our simulations as a function of n, which seems to grow very slowly. Here, for big n, there is an anomaly, which is caused by the way in which the instances were generated. And the point is that for very big n, generating instances of an empty complete problem is also a very, very difficult problem. Right. And the instances that you generate, by definition, have to be easy, because if not, you were not able to generate. Right? That is because you have some kind of a slowing down of this plot here. And also here in the instance, it shows the worst case, which you can also see this effect even more precisely. Okay, so the big transparencies were about simulations of adiabatic quantum algorithms. Now let me think of another possibility. Imagine that I want to find the ground state of my problem Hamiltonian, right, which codifies the solution to my instance. Now, how can I do this? I can do DMRG, as I was doing before, density matrix normalization group. And another alternative is to make Euclidean time evolution. That is, I begin with an arbitrary state which has non-zero overlap with the ground state of my system, okay? And I apply this operator, which is unphysical because this is not a unitary operator. Okay, time here is Euclidean. There is not an I here. Okay. Now, if I apply this operator over an arbitrary state, eventually I will have a very high probability of having the ground state of HP, and this is called Euclidean time evolution for finding ground states. Right. Now, I can do the same discretization into in this case, they are not unitary gates, but into some two-qubit gates and so on, and apply the updating procedures on matrix for the states, which basically work in the same way than for unitary gates. And here is the one of the plots that we got for an instance of 26 qubits with a chi equal to 6. This is the entanglement entropy, and the probability of success that goes to 1. And this finds the correct solution much faster than the adiabatic simulations. But much faster, I mean, order of magnitude much faster. Yes?
So in this case, you would not just have to know that you're, well, somewhere near the ground state, you also have to know the eigenvalue,
no,
the energy, I suppose. Otherwise, I mean, in the other case, you were losing a little bit of probability.
No, here what is happening.
Here you could lose a lot of probability.
Well, the eigenvalue, you can fix the eigenvalue of your ground state to 0 in this case.
Oh, you do that. Okay.
In this case, yes.
I see.
So this is a very good way of finding ground states, by Euclidean. If you want a classical algorithm to find ground states, this is a very good option. Okay, alternative to density matrix normalization. Okay, so let me go for the conclusions. In the first part of the talk, I told you I explained you that measurization along L and parameter randomization of group flows can be proven for some integrable theories in 1+1 dimensions. If we assume some appropriate conditions for our theories, okay, and using conformality theory, and this proves some conjectures previously raised for quantum spin chains, basically these majorization relations that were conjectures in previous papers of many people, some people, right? And hints a way to prove irreversibility of randomization group flows in more than one, in more than 1+1 dimensions. And in the second part of the talk, I have explained you that matrix flutter states are a useful computational tool for calculating random states and dynamical properties of many interesting physical systems, like, for example, spin models, but they can also be continuous variables models, whatever. Okay. And on top, these matrix flutter state simulations of quantum computations can handle a relatively large number of qubits with reasonable approximation schemes that are always, you can always control these approximations. So that is. Okay, so let me put just one last transparency, which is the future, which are the generalizations of these matrix product states. The two options are PEPS, or projected entangled pure states, which is nothing but the trivial, or what, not trivial, but naive generalization of what is a matrix product state in one dimension, but generalized to more than one dimension, for example, in the plane. And this has been successfully applied to calculate the ground state properties and correlators and energies of two-dimensional systems, right? And the second generalization is based on the idea of adding to a matrix for the state something that is called disentangling unitaries, and then the state that you get is has some kind of fractal structure like this. This is a diagram that represents the state. The state, I mean, this was proposed by Jeffrey Vidal, I think it was a couple of months ago or something like that. And basically, this is the way, these two options are the way in which the future simulations of quantum many-body systems have to go in order to generalize them to two-dimensional systems, okay, which is open landscape, nobody knows what is going on there for many different models, okay, and of course higher dimensions. And well, this is all I wanted to tell you. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, any questions?
So in your simulations of the adiabatic algorithm using matrix product states, I'm curious, if you restricted the loss of norm to be small, so say part in thousands, how large a system could you simulate?
Well, the point is that small, because the loss of norm is very big,
right.
Okay? Or at least you have to go to very large scales. But I think that in the plot that I was showing you, let me, If you realize the loss of norm was of the order of 10 to the minus 3 in some cases, okay, 10 to the minus, no, that was not, that was the norm, okay, the norm was of the order of 10 to the minus 4.
Actually, yeah, can we see the picture again?
Yes. Let me. Okay, so this was the picture, right?
So what's on the?
This is, yeah, this is the biggest one. This is chi, okay? And this is the norm, okay? It's the norm. And you can see that the smaller is your system, it is close to one, but for 30 qubits, it's of the order of 10 to the minus 4, something like that. It's actually a bit bigger, no? For chi, 1 to 30, I think it was this. But you can run up simulations up to 100 or 200 also, okay? And go to norms of the order of 10 to the minus 2.
Okay. So, I mean, what I'm just curious, what do you think is the biggest system that you can handle with that, you know, by increasing chi?
By increasing the bigger system. You mean, but in a simulation of an of this,
yes.
Of this NP complete problem. I don't know, but I can tell you that the people have simulated systems up to thousands of qubits, not of one-dimensional system. Okay. This is not a one-dimensional system, but I guess that probably you can go to hundreds.
I mean, from this figure, if you have five, 20 or so, it seems like even with a very small system, and is that 14 is the highest curve?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it's not true. But they're already, the norm is something like half.
Yeah. But the point is that this has to be very small, okay? Of course, because this is precisely in the parameter in which you are truncating, okay?
No.
And this, like, this error is not
larger than you can make it bigger, so.
Exactly. But this error is also multiplicative, okay? So every time you are playing a QTV game, you are multiplying the norm that you have by the previous one, and so on, okay? So it goes very drastically to zero, very quickly. Let's say it's a way of. This is a way of looking at your error, but somehow it is a little bit unfair because, of course, it has to be bad because it's preserving the parameter in which you are truncating. Okay. Another way of looking at the error is to see the relative error of the energy, which is the previous slide. Okay. This is what the people look in BMLG. Yes.
So the critical state is an einsatz and the energy of entanglement, some of the dimensions.
Is an einsatz, huh?
Einsatz.
Yes.
Double G of entanglement in the system.
Exactly. I mean, it is an einsatz for your ground state, okay? Which depends on the matrices, and the size of these matrices are parameterized by some number, chi, which determines the entanglement in your system. So you are putting the maximum entanglement at hand at the beginning.
But when you apply this DMRG on it, do you get something which is local? I mean, is the mapping between this this auxiliary space in which you define your first state, your brick state, as a mapping between this space and the actual space physical system, that stay local compared to the way you shape the real name?
What do you mean by local?
I mean that do you have a sort of identification between your product states and the actual space?
Actually, the spins are represented by the circles. Okay, do you remember the picture?
Well, they are.
Sorry.
They are actually. I mean, they are actually one thing.
So exactly, you are mapping two ancillary systems to one physical system, right? Yes. Let me show you that. Here. These two dots here are some imaginary systems, okay, that I invent in order to make a description of my state. Okay, but they are not real. They call them ancillary systems. Right. Now my physical system is going to be a projection of the Hilbert space of these two guys, which do not exist in nature, to some physical system, which is represented by this circle. Okay. And the index of my physical system is going to be I, whereas the index of the ancillary guys are the alphas. Okay. And this is a projector. You are picking up two indices here to one. So you are projecting the Hilbert space to a reduced dimension.
And so this topology is a topology of the speed chain.
Exactly. This is an answer. You're assuming that this has the topology of a one dimensional speed chain. Exactly.
So for the two different cases you show at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So you are up. It means you can only get a system where the entanglement entropy grows as L.
In the case of two dimensions.
This,
here. Well, in this case, what happens with the entanglement entropy is that it is bounded by the area of the moment. So with this pet of projected entanglement, you recover in a very natural way with this entanglement area law for the scaling.
It cannot simulate something which is more entangled.
Exactly. But this is the typical scaling that you have in quantum systems in two dimensions or in more. Okay, you have the scaling typically scales like this. But of course, if the scaling of the entanglement is like the volume, you cannot represent that state with a depth, at least with a finite guide. Okay. Another thing that has to be proven is whether these states, these generalizations to two dimensions, is also dense. So you can represent any quantum state with this picture. Okay.
Just to remind you what chi is.
Chi is the maximum Smith rank of the reduced density matrices of your system, right? So you make a partition of your system, right? And you get a reduced density matrix, and this reduced density matrix has a fixed number of non-zero eigenvalues, okay? That is the rank. So you do this for all the possible partitions of your system, and you pick up the maximum of the ranks of the reduced density matrices, and this maximum is chi, precisely the parameter in which you have to truncate. And this is a measure of the maximum bipartite entanglement that is present in your register.
Okay. More questions?